May it please the court and your honors, it's a very great pleasure to be back here in person. So,
and I did forget to say there is the timer is right before you, so just watch that for your countdown.
Very good, your honor. I'm colorblind, so I'll look at the numbers. I don't want to get it wrong. May it please the court, this appeal presents a single question of law for the court, and that is whether there is underinsured motorist coverage for Appley Anselmo Consonsing under his auto policy, despite the policy's self-insurer exception, which excludes vehicles owned or operated by a self-insurer from the definition of uninsured motor vehicles for purposes of UM-UIM coverage. And justices, there are three reasons for finding that the appellee is not entitled to UM-UIM coverage. The first reason is that the plain language of the standard auto policy and its self-insurer exception preclude such coverage, as Enterprise Rental Car is a self-insurer under the policy's unambiguous terms and the applicable provisions of the Texas Transportation Code. The Fifth Circuit's decision in McQuinney is directly on point on all fours and holds that the self-insurer exception under Texas law, and this is important because the appellee is running to Connecticut and Tennessee law, and the applicable law in this case is Texas law.
But doesn't the McKinney opinion, and I have it somewhere here, in the asterisk of per curiam, specifically sets out that it does not have any precedent value. Its asterisk under per curiam specifically sets forth, pursuant to the Fifth Circuit 47 point, this court has determined that this opinion should not be published and is not precedent except under the limited circumstances, and then we can look to the rule. So why are we to look at a Fifth Circuit case where they specifically told us, don't look at it?
Justice Benavides, it's a good question. Respectfully, it is not controlling law. It is not required. This court is not required to look at it. But the fact is that what the Fifth Circuit did in McQuinney was it did march through Texas law. And I would suggest that the McQuinney's assessment, which is basically takes apart each and every argument that the appellee makes here, McQuinney is important, Justice Benavides, because it looks at Texas law. And the contractual methodologies in Texas and contractual interpretation in Texas is completely different than in Connecticut and in Tennessee. And so
I would agree with you, except for the fact that McQuinney doesn't really do any analysis of what self-insurance means. And would you agree that the issue we have here is what does self-insured mean under your policy?
Yes, Your Honor.
And it doesn't do any analysis of what self-insurance means in McQuinney. They just kind of skip over that whole analysis.
Justice Benavides, I'd suggest that what McQuinney does is it does a nuts and bolts analysis. It goes through the applicable words of the self-insurer exception. It goes through this question, and this was raised, Justice Benavides, in the court below. It was not raised, this question of contractual interpretation. And the appellee's view of the contractual interpretation, we would say, is 100% wrong, and I think they believe it's wrong, because 18 pages of their brief addresses public policy. It does not march, their brief does not march through the applicable language. Their position, consistent with what they've said in Connecticut and Tennessee, is this construction just can't stand. Whether or not the language is clear on its face, this can't be the rule.
Well, and if we take this to the first extent, the public policy, we can have that whole argument under public policy. But the question I have is even more basic than that. Is this vehicle self-insured under this policy as written under? And it takes me back to my first year at Adams and Graham, 35 years, where all the new associates all had to do coverage issue.
Sure.
And that the policies are interpreted against the insurance company when we look at them. And does self-insurance, as not defined, but in the plain language, is Hertz really, I mean, not Hertz, Enterprise, I keep calling it Hertz. I did this morning when I was talking to my fellow colleagues. Is it really self-insured? in light of this policy and in light of what it is, which is you can't be sued under the Graves Amendment?
Your Honor, let me, this is a very interesting question. Let me unpack some of what I see as in that question.
Okay.
First, there is a definition of self-insurance. I don't agree that there is not a definition. And the definition is plain on its face. And Justice, you'll find, this is at Clerk's Record 74. It's in our summary judgment motion. The definition of the self-insurer exception is that it precludes UM/UIM coverage when the insured has an accident with a vehicle, quote, owned or operated by a self-insurer under any applicable vehicle law. That's the definitional provision.
Except a self-insurer that is or becomes insolvent.
Mm-hmm. Right, and insolvency, they focused on insolvency in the court below. There's no question of insolvency. It would come as a very great shock.
Yeah, but when you look
it's a very broad definition is what you're saying.
Yes, it is.
It's very broad.
It's a very broad definition. It's very few words. And at Appendix 6 of the appellant's brief, we have the certificates of insurance, of self-insurance that were issued by the Department of Public Safety pursuant to the Texas Transportation Code. They're 2 pages. It would come as a shock to Enterprise and to the Department of Public Safety to learn that they're not self-insured. And it judges
not. Under Black's insurance, self-insurance means a plan under which a business maintains its own special fund to cover any loss. Well, it doesn't cover a loss in this case. The Graves Amendment doesn't give you a loss. You don't have a plan that covers a loss in this motor vehicle accident because you are immune under the federal statute.
That's true, Judge.
So how is self-insurance, as defined by Black's law, relevant in this case? Why do we even look at you? Do we even look at Enterprise?
We look at Enterprise, Your Honor, and I would go back to this. My second point of my argument, which is, and I understand this is what the court is interested in, and so I'm going to address it. I'm not skirting the question. But the auto policy is a highly regulated form. And to the extent that the court believes that in this circumstance, and just Benavides, to go back to it, the Graves Amendment doesn't provide complete and absolute immunity for rental car companies. They have potential liability for their own torts. They have potential liability for their own wrongdoing. The Graves Amendment precludes vicarious liability. Right. And to go to your point, just because this is the nut of it.
Right.
If that vicarious liability, if the fact that the appellee cannot recover underinsured motorist coverage means that there's a gap in coverage, which is what I perceive the court to be saying, there's a fix for that, Judge, and the fix is up the road in Austin. The Texas legislature can fix this. The Department of Insurance can fix this. And the public policy, that public policy argument was waived by the appellee. It is not in any of the briefing in the summary judgment motion below. They have not raised that issue. Here in this court, and I believe this is, and I've argued this 8 or 10 times in the trial courts, this is the better argument that the public policy as articulated and the briefing, and it's good briefing, and these are great lawyers. The briefing here is consistent entirely with what the Connecticut court said and what the Tennessee court said. But in Texas, we don't look at contracts the way they do in Connecticut and Tennessee. And Justice Benavides, respectfully, I disagree with this court's assertion that language of limitation, exclusions, are held against and limited in their construction against the insurance company.
I was always taught you don't walk your insured out of, when you're reviewing a policy. Of course, it's been 35 years. you never walk your insured out of a policy unless it's plain language. And I know that that's what you're arguing, that plainly here this exclusion walks them and there's a gap and then you got to fix that gap. I don't know exactly how you would fix that gap, to be perfectly honest, even if we were up to the road to Austin, but be it as it may.
Well, if it goes to the Department of Insurance or legislature, Judge, they can write it out of the policy. We litigated hundreds of cases in the late 90s and early 2000s related to the settlement exclusion in the homeowners policy. Was there coverage for plumbing leaks? Was it excluded by settlement? There were lots of cases, but that form was then changed by the Department of Insurance. And the HOA form, the homeowners A form, resolved that issue. In other words, there was a fix at the Department of Insurance. But what we've got here is we do apply the plain language. For years, the perception was, well, we hold these terms against the carrier. That's not the law. The Texas Supreme Court in CBI, which was an absolute pollution exclusion, looked at this case, this question very carefully, and said we apply plain language. And what that means is, and is this problematic? Well, but this is how we do it in Texas. The mere disputation of the parties, mere disputation, doesn't create ambiguity. We don't apply contra pro ferentum. We don't apply against the drafter unless the plain language of the policy in and of itself creates ambiguity. And then against the drafter comes in and the policyholder wins. But you don't use against the drafter to say, well, this is ambiguous. And the other side's assertion of, well, we've got a pretty good explanation for how this works. The fact is that the underinsured motorist provision in the policy, Justice Benavides, is not a blanket guarantee of underinsured coverage in all circumstances. It simply isn't. There are other exclusions in there.
Let me ask you a question about the public policy before you run short on time.
Yes, Justice Contreras.
So you said that they waived that because it wasn't raised at the trial court, but this is a summary judgment that was denied. And we realize that, you know, we're confined to the record in the trial court below, but as I understand our standard of review, when it's denied, we can take a consideration any theory that the motion could have been denied on. So can we as an appellate court then consider public policy, even though they did not raise it below?
Your Honor, I believe you can. I think that this issue of public policy, the important point for me is that it was not raised in the court below, and this is a new issue that the appellee is injecting here, and the reason they're doing it is they're running from their own contractual construction from the court below because the public policy argument is a better argument, and that's what we're addressing. The fact is, though, this question of public policy, which is derived from Connecticut and Tennessee, and I don't want to beat a dead horse here, but again, the policy...
Don't beat up on Connecticut.
You're running a Connecticut Yankee, I guess. So can I throw that in as well, just as Benavides? The fact is that in Connecticut, there are a number of rules for contract interpretation that are very different. For one, and this is from the case is the Tannen case, 2018 Connecticut case that the appellee relies on, and Martin is the Tennessee case. In Connecticut and Tennessee, the ordinary meaning envisioned by the policy is that envisioned by the average policyholder. The language of the insurance contract in Connecticut and Tennessee must be read as the layman would read it. Contracts in Tennessee and Connecticut are strictly construed in favor of the insured. Those are vastly different. That isn't what we do here. That's not what the Texas Supreme Court did in CBI with the absolute pollution exclusion. It's not if you look at the language for how do we interpret insurance policies, the Blandrin case, I could say
everything in Texas different.
It is different.
And I have another question for you that you probably need to ponder and then respond to on rebuttal if you prefer. But it's a question as to whether our jurisdiction is impacted. That was something we just realized. This order was denied on March 12th. Under the rules and the Civil Practice and Remedies Code, you had 15 days to file the petition for permissive appeal with our court. Instead of that, a motion to reconsider was filed with the trial court on the 15th day. And then, sometime down the road, again, and another order denying was signed, and then you filed your petition from that date. The question is, does that motion to reconsider restart the timeline for this purpose? And I realize this is an agreed petition, and we've granted it, but it's really a question of do we even have jurisdiction if, in fact, this motion to reconsider does not restart your timeline as it does in other as it does not in other contexts.
Just as a follow-up, that's the same issue you had in the McCormick San Antonio, which the Supreme Court just denied.
I see my time is up. The answer is this court can address the issue, and I'll address it on rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you so much.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
May it please the court. Defendant's argument is too clever by half. I would say, contrary to what opposing counsel had said, that the plain meaning of the contractual language supports us. Their argument sets aside context and common sense. They argue that even though the vehicle at issue was not self-insured as to the relevant risk, it is self-insured under the policy. As Justice Benavides says, the Black's Law Dictionary defines it as self-insurance as they agree to cover any loss. Enterprise's certificate of self-insurance is meant to protect it from liability for damages caused by its employees' operation of the vehicles. Enterprise cannot self-insure a vehicle against lessee losses because it is statutorily immune under the Graves Amendment for damages caused by a lessee. In this case, though, the person who hit Mr. Kautzonzing was a lessee. Defendant accuses plaintiffs of adding words to the policy, but this is not true because the contract uses the word self-insurance, which is at best ambiguous. A risk is inherent in the concept of insurance. If there is no risk, there can be no insurance or self-insurance. Under defendant's reasoning, a vehicle would be self-insured even if it was only self-insured for hail damage, as long as some motor vehicle law allowed an owner to insure a car for hail damage. Before I get too far, I did want to address the waiver argument for our public policy because I agree that that is another strong argument in our favor. First of all, we did not waive this because it was raised below. Although we did not use the exact words, Texas public policy, in the response, our entire argument was that defendant's interpretation of the policy was inconsistent with Texas public policy. For example, we say that defendant's interpretation, quote, makes no sense because the purpose of UIM insurance is to protect responsible drivers from damages incurred as a result of drivers without sufficient insurance. We say that on page 102 of the clerk's record. That is talking about the purpose of the UIM statute and is very squarely a public policy argument. Indeed, we make the very argument that defendant claims is waived at the trial court. Defendant says that we waive the argument that the statute should control over policy definitions because it is a public policy argument. But this was one of our main arguments at the trial court, that the policy language contradicted the Texas statutes. And that is at pages 90 to 93 of the clerk's record, and then 103 to 105. But second, maybe even more importantly, we didn't waive anything because we are asking the court to affirm the denial of a summary judgment motion. And I think that Justice Contreras was getting at this. Defendant cites a rule that says issues not expressly presented to the trial court by written motion, answer, or other response shall not be considered on appeal as grounds for reversal. Well, we are not asking this court to reverse the denial of the summary judgment. We're asking this court to affirm the denial of the summary judgment. Similarly, a court cannot affirm the grant of a motion for summary judgment on grounds not contained in the motion. But here, we are seeking to affirm the denial of a motion for summary judgment. In other words, we're not seeking reversal, and we're not seeking summary judgment. We want this court to affirm the denial of a summary judgment motion. But the defendant does not even respond to our public policy arguments on the merits. It's unsurprising that they don't, because there is a strong public policy in Texas in favor of UIM coverage, so that responsible people like Mr. Kautzonzing can protect themselves from the risk of being hit by drivers who don't have proper insurance or enough insurance to cover their injuries.
Now, Mrs. Gaitan, who was the person who hit him, rear-ended him.
Yes, Your Honor.
She had insurance. Is that correct?
She did have insurance, yes, Your Honor.
And that was resolved in some manner, and then the claim was made.
Yes, Your Honor.
So does it make a difference in that there was, this car was insured, at least in part?
Yes, Your Honor.
When we're looking at the coverage of the definition of self-insured?
No, Your Honor, I don't think that it ultimately makes a difference, and I have two things to say on that. One is it's not unusual that there are multiple insurance policies, and the question for whether a vehicle is underinsured has to do with whether the damages exceed what he was able to get from Ms. Gaitan. And that's really not an issue here because we haven't gotten, you know, damages are very facty issues and we haven't gotten into the facts. But we've asserted that his damages exceed what he was able to obtain.
Does it affect the definition as we look for under the policy under underinsured that there was at least, it definitely wasn't uninsured, right?
Because yes, Your Honor.
There was some insurance.
Yes,
so
Your
when
Honor.
You go to underinsured defined as a policy and it excludes self-insurance, I'm trying to get around of how do we meld that this car, Ms. Gaitan's car, had both insurance and was a rental car. When we look at how we exclude it under the policy.
Yes, Your Honor, I think that that's a separate issue because the issue in this appeal is the definition of self-insurance and whether or not their interpretation of the policy is against Texas public policy. And there's no argument that Ms. Gaitan was self-insured. She just had insurance. And one thing that I would note, and I'm going to get into this a little bit later, because I disagree with some of the characterizations of the differences between Texas law and Connecticut and Tennessee law. But in the Tanon case, it was exactly the same situation where the other driver had an insurance policy and they settled with the other driver and then made a claim on their uninsured motorist policy.
How do we get around the reality here that UIM coverage is not required in Texas? I mean, it's not a given that anybody's entitled to that type of recovery. And it's unfortunate, but it's the case. Liability, yes, is required, but that's where the legislature has stopped. And these insurance policies, whether we agree with them or not, this one in particular has been approved, you know, by the insurance code authorizes it, and the commissioners approved it. So, how do we get around that they are entitled to have such a policy? As unfair as it may seem, if we do a real strict analysis of the terms, as appellant is arguing, we should. How do we get around the fact that that's just the way it can be?
Yes, Your Honor, and the Tanon Court actually dealt with this exact same issue. And we're not saying that the self-insurance clause is bad. In fact, it's very important and makes a whole lot of sense. If you get hit by somebody who is self-insured and actually has an obligation to pay losses as that definition.
Such as the vehicle driven by Walmart.
Right, exactly. Exactly. If there was a vehicle driven by Walmart, it would be absurd plaintiff's gamesmanship for the plaintiff to sue Walmart for $1 million and say, oh, well, Walmart is uninsured, therefore I can also collect on my uninsured motorist policy even though my damages are entirely covered. This policy is meant to protect that sort of plaintiff's gamesmanship. It's very clear, and it's an irony in this case that defendant is using it for gamesmanship, even though enterprise's certificate of self-insurance is meant to be self-insurance for its employees, not for its lessees. And to address the other aspect of justice,
is that somewhere in the record what you've just said there?
The
employees.
that the self-insurance is meant for their employees and not for
Oh, no, Your Honor, it's I'm inferring that from the fact that the Graves Amendment preclude liability for enterprise
right.
for lessee risks.
Yeah.
And so the just thinking of what
here.
Logically what the purpose
the federal
would be.
Government.
Well, for instance, but I'm thinking about why enterprise might still want to have a certificate.
So they have
of
a certificate of insurance for the state of Texas, but that certificate of insurance would only be valid to its own employees.
Exactly.
Okay,
exactly.
That makes
they
sense.
Have it, but that's the only kinds of damages that it would pay. So the objective of, and this is from a case that was writ refused NRE, the objective of the legislature in passing the uninsured motorist statute was to provide financial protection for responsible motorists like Mr. Kaltzonsing, damaged by tortfeasors who are unable to pay for the damage inflicted. That's exactly the sort of situation that we have here where enterprise is precluded from federal law from being liable for these damages. And it says, it further says, because of the remedial purpose of underinsured motorist coverage, the words providing an exception to the general rule of coverage should be strictly construed to protect the insured. And I understand, and this court has just recently said, Justice Benavides was alluding to, that when a policy is ambiguous, and we would say that at best it's ambiguous here, it is strictly construed against the insurer and liberally for the insured. This court just cited that language in the Moserv case. So it creates an obvious gap in coverage. I wasn't able to find great statistics, but according to Statista.com, they expect about 12.3% of people in America are going to use a rental car at some point in 2022. And so they're taking this provision that is meant to prevent plaintiffs' gamesmanship if they're hit by a vehicle driven by Walmart, for instance, and making it so that there are these random cars, randomly selected, driving out on Texas roads that if they hit you, sorry, there's no way you can get any insurance coverage, even if you were perspicacious enough to purchase uninsured motorist coverage, as Mr. Kaltzonsing was. This creates a huge problem. And as I said, we didn't waive the public policy argument, and even if we hadn't
How
raised
we get
it, this
around,
court can consider it.
The analysis, setting aside that it tells us it's not precedent value in McQueenie,
yes.
But how do we get around the analysis of McQueenie that goes through the arguments and basically says you lose?
Your Honor, so I would say, what I would say, if as long as we're just pitting precedents against each other, right. As you had said at the beginning, McQueenie is not mandatory authority even in the Fifth Circuit, and it's certainly not mandatory authority for a state court interpreting state law. I would say that
so
how
you think they got the interpretation analysis wrong in McQueenie?
There is one distinction that I will get to, but okay. I do think that they got the analysis wrong, and that the Tannone and Martin cases, which are interpreting like just very similar law,
except the argument that that's been made by appellant is that the Tannone and the other one, the type of analysis that they can do in those states is different from what we can do in Texas. Texas law doesn't really permit us to go outside the terms of the contract.
Yes, Your Honor, I would disagree with the opposing counsel's analysis on that issue. As I said in those quotes that I did from Texas, this is from Texas authority and even from this court, that where the contract is ambiguous, and the Tannone court did find that it was ambiguous, it is strictly construed against the insurer and liberally for the insured. And in fact, this is maybe a good entry into one of our other arguments that we had in the brief about how absurd their interpretation is. It's not the plain meaning of this provision in context. So under defendants,
the only way we find an ambiguity is if we look outside the terms of the contract to say, okay, the Graves Amendment results in this inequity, therefore, you know, there's a question as to what really it means here. So we do have to go outside the contract itself.
Your Honor, I don't think that you need to go outside of the contract itself, because I think that the term self-insurer itself is ambiguous, as indicated by the quote from Black's Law Dictionary, which is just interpreting the word. That's not outside. That's just linguistics. Mm-hmm. Looking at the contract itself, I think that using the term self-insurance is ambiguous because it's implied. Usually, if I said, my house is self-insured, but what I meant was that it's self-insured for hail damage, or that I'm going to be able to pay hail damage. I think that there's inherent ambiguity in the term self-insurance, which is also what the Tannone Court held by just looking at that term and how Black's Law Dictionary and other sources have defined it. I don't think that it went out of, I don't think that it looked at extrinsic evidence. I think that it just looked at the sorts of linguistic aids that you would look to, like Black's Law Dictionary and that sort of thing, to find the ambiguity. Under defendant's literalistic reading, if a person owned two cars, or say that, you know, Tom owns Tom's rental car company, and Tom also, he's a self-employer. You know, Tom has his own separate car, but he also has his rental car company. And he has insurance for his regular car that he drives to work every day, and he has self-insurance for his rental car company. As absurd as it sounds, under defendant's reading of this policy language, even if Tom hits you with his car that he drives on his way to work, driving his separate car that is not self-insured, under defendant's reading of this policy, you would not be able to get uninsured motorist coverage if your damages exceeded Tom's insurance coverage. And that's because Tom is a self-insurer under a Texas statute. And what they're saying is, even though this does not cover any of the damages that were suffered in this case, a self-insurer is a self-insurer is a self-insurer. And so under that hypothetical, Tom would be a self-insurer and you wouldn't be able to get any underinsured motorists. And I think that reading, which is exactly what they're arguing, is just absurd. It cannot be what it means. And I think that the way that you get there interpretatively is by looking at the word self-insurer and recognizing that it is an ambiguous term in itself, which the policy, contrary to opposing counsel, does not actually define. I don't think that the words under any motor vehicle law is a definition of self-insurer, because you have to determine what that the content, you have to determine the linguistic content of the term self-insurer. I also wanted to address something that else that's in their brief. They say that they cry foul when we use the language is or becomes insolvent in our argument, since there is no evidence in the record regarding enterprise's insolvency. But first of all, and this is a very small point, defendant had the burden of establishing its affirmative defense as a matter of law, so it was required to prove that an enterprise was solvent. The fact that there's no evidence in the record means that defendant failed to meet its burden, even under its own incorrect interpretation of the contract. But that's a much more minor point. Second, and far more importantly, defendant misses the point of this argument. It's black letter law that courts must interpret a contract holistically and in context. You have to look to harmonize all the provisions of the contract. The words is or become insolvent show unmistakably that the purpose of the contractual language is not to arbitrarily exclude self-insurers under any motor vehicle law, but rather to reflect the common sense reality that a self-insurer, when it's actually liable for paying judgments, is actually insured. I think that the Martin court explained it very well. And that involved exactly the same policy language. And this particular analysis is extremely consistent with Texas law. They said, although the policy does not define the term self-insurer, the policy's exclusion of vehicles owned by a self-insurer from the definition of uninsured motor vehicles does not apply when the self-insurer is or becomes insolvent. This language reflects the underlying purpose of uninsured motorist coverage, which is to pay compensation to the insured policy owner when the liable third party is unable to do so. In light of the underlying recognition that one who qualifies as a self-insurer is able to pay assessed liabilities, the policy language acknowledges that a self-insurer who is insolvent is, in actual fact and operation, not a self-insurer at all. Accordingly, the policy itself limits the exclusion of motor vehicles owned by self-insurers to those vehicles owned by self-insurers who are capable of paying damages assessed against them. If the self-insured owner is insolvent, the vehicle is covered by is considered uninsured under the terms of the policy itself. And so this is just more textual evidence that the intent of the policy, that the purpose of the parties to the agreement, as expressed in the language of the policy, is to prevent this sort of plaintiff's gamesmanship, but not to preclude recovery for plaintiffs who happen to be hit by rental car drivers. Again, as we say in the brief, that's just absurd as having a policy exclusion for people hit by red cars. I can't control if a negligent rental car driver hits me or not. Finally, the statutory language, and we did have this argument in our brief at the trial court too, the statutory language established that Enterprise is not self-insured here. The statute states that the department is satisfied that the person has and will continue to have the ability to pay judgments obtained against the person. I see that I'm out of time. Do you mind if I finish
go
this
ahead and
point?
Finish, and you should have been given a warning.
I apologize.
A 2-minute warning or anything. Yeah. The yellow light's supposed to come on before the red light.
Yes, Your Honor. I am so sorry.
go ahead.
But Enterprise does not have the ability to pay judgments because it's exempt under federal law. And so just wrapping up quickly, this is further evidence that under Texas law, they're not self-insured in this context under the meaning of the policy. We urge this court to adopt a common sense reading of the insurance contract that does not violate Texas public policy. Thank you.
I know that it's not in your brief, but I do want to end of whether you have thought at all of whether there is a jurisdictional issue that just Chief Justice Contreras discussed as
Your Honor,
the untimely filing of this permissive appeal.
Your Honor, just in full candor, I did look into that issue, but we had decided not to raise it because we don't think that there is a jurisdiction.
You know, I always have that problem because I know that y'all really want us to get to the merits, and we really want to get to the merits. But if we don't have jurisdiction, we don't have jurisdiction.
Yes, Your Honor.
So it's always, I mean, we'd love to hear every case.
He's
going to
address it, though. Let him
okay.
address it. And
so
then we'll
I just
think. Then we'll ask for briefing.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. I have a few points in rebuttal, three of them, but let me address the jurisdictional issue, Justice Benavides and Chief Justice Contreras, because it's important. And there is not a jurisdictional issue here. You'll find the summary judgment order is at Appendix 2 of the appellant's brief, and then at Appendix 4, and this is the important order, there's an amended order for summary judgment. And this issue of jurisdiction under the CPRC is one that there's clarity on here. If the court looks at it, and we haven't briefed the issue because both sides believe that there is jurisdiction, but Sabine Travel is the operative Texas Supreme Court case. In McCormick, the case that I had up on appeal, the court recently in December denied discretionary review. The denial of discretionary review in McCormick it wasn't petition refused. It's not a statement that the Court of Appeals got it right. It was a statement that we don't want to hear the case. For whatever reason, it was disappointing for us, Your Honor. But the fact is that the Court of Appeals in McCormick, the San Antonio Court, looked at this question. And we raised the issue for the Texas Supreme Court, and we didn't get resolution of the procedural issue. But the CPRC issue is absolutely clear. And if you think of it this way, Justice Benavides, this has to be the rule. Defendant moves for summary judgment. The trial court says, summary judgment denied. That's it. You're done. The trial court doesn't give reasons. Very infrequently do they give reasons for the summary judgment. The practice is summary judgment denied. At Appendix 4, you'll find the amended motion for summary judgment. And amended order. And what Sabine Travel says is, in order to have an interlocutory permissive appeal, the trial court has to first identify the controlling question of law. It has to provide the information in response with an order that we can appeal from.
Okay.
I couldn't appeal from the first order. It says summary judgment denied. I was disappointed, but then we went back to the trial court and we said, one, we want you to reconsider your summary judgment. I knew that wasn't going to happen, but we do that. But the important point was We asked the trial court to certify it. We identified the controlling question of law, and we showed how it was outcome dispositive in this case. And then the court agreed, not as to merits, but as to the importance of this permissive appeal.
Okay.
And so the timing question should run from the amended order, and I don't believe that Appellee disagrees with that.
Okay.
To respond, I have a couple minutes to respond to some of the points, and one of the first points I'd like to respond to, Justice Contreras, and it goes to your question to counsel. It goes to counsel's statement that it cannot be what it means. That cannot be what it means. That's not contract interpretation. That's the sense that this result is a bad result, and this is bad policy. And this underinsured motorist provision is not a blanket guarantee of underinsurance under many circumstances. Governmental immunity. There are thousands of governmental vehicles out on the road. If you get hit by a governmental vehicle, you don't have underinsured coverage. Is that good policy? I'd argue that this sense that public policy is somehow relevant to the interpretive mode that the court operates, that's a very blunt instrument. We can always say the court can sit applying public policy and choose winners and losers, irrespective of policy language, irrespective of contractual provisions. And that's a very slippery slope, because once we change the mode of contractual interpretation, and I see my time is almost up. We
got the yellow light this time.
Yes, it's there. He didn't get a warning. That's a slippery slope. There's lots of employment contracts, other kinds of contracts. If we say public policy trumps plain language, that's problematic. And the last point I would make is that the Graves Amendment does not mean an enterprise is not self-insured. Enterprise, again, is self-insured for its own torts, for negligent entrustment. If Enterprise rents a vehicle and the vehicle has a bad tire, and they know it has a bad tire, and they rent it anyway, and then there's a suit and someone is injured, Enterprise is self-insured for its own torts. It is not true that they don't have self-insurance. And the certificates that you have in evidence, which were issued by the Department of Public Safety, pursuant to the Texas Transportation Code, indicate that, in fact, today, Enterprise is a self-insured entity. I see my time is up, and I thank the court for its attention.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Very interesting case. It will be under submission.
Thank you.